Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, we discuss two of the most highly anticipated films from this year's Eight Films to Die For series. First up, from the motion picture Borderland, writer-director Zev Berman, producer Lauren Mays, and actor-writer Strong. Then, writer-director Rolf Konevsky stops by to tell us all about his film, Nightmare Man. It is all coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Welcome to Movie Geeks United, especially to all those horror fans out there. We've given you a great month so far of horror film programming. My name is Jamie, and I'm one of your co-hosts for the evening, and we have Jerry here, too. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, how you doing? How's everyone doing out there?
It's been a great month for Movie Geeks United, and we thank all of our loyal listeners and all of our new listeners who have just joined us as well. If you subscribe to our show by iTunes, I want to get this out of the way right now. You can not only catch up on our great archived programming, like our recent interviews with Saw 4-star Lyric Bent, which opened big this weekend. I don't know if you saw that, Jerry.
No, it opened very big. I mean, as expected, but you know,
yeah,
it's just amazing how much it dwarfs the other movies out there.
Yeah. We also, what else have we had recently on the program? It's been tremendous.
We had All About the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah, we had the retrospective on Chainsaw with Daniel Pearl, the cinematographer of the original and the first remake.
Yeah, that was a very informative show because there's a lot of stuff I didn't know that I learned from that.
Absolutely. And we, outside of horror films, we had our Stanley Kubrick Eyes Wide Shut tribute as well. Heard from some of his closest collaborators during that show and got a sense of the man and the artist and how he worked and how he thought. Which was an amazing show, and it's been extremely popular, and we thank everyone for listening in on that one as well. But if you subscribe by iTunes, you'll get all of those previous shows, about 41 of them, I believe, we're on to now. And you'll also get our future shows automatically updated onto your iTunes drive, including a show this Wednesday night where we will speak with the legendary producer A. Kitman Ho, who produced a lot of Oliver Stone's most breathtaking work, like Platoon and JFK. And
Imagine the stories. I mean, that's just a lot of stories there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm fascinated by Oliver Stone, so that'll be a great conversation. His new film that he just produced is Reservation Road, by the way, with Joaquin Phoenix and Jennifer Connelly. We'll also be speaking to screenwriting guru Blake Snyder that evening, and we'll hopefully be able to get a sense of, among other things, this looming writer strike. And I think the 31st is the deadline for it.
Yeah, the 31st after midnight. Boom. It's
So we'll get up to date on that. Sunday the 4th, we have a marketing and distribution expert, Mark Bosco. And the following Sunday, to celebrate the 25th year of Poltergeist, we have that film's writer-producer, Michael Graves.
And a lot of interest in that show already.
Yeah, very much so. This is a movie that, there's a reason why it survived for 25 years. It doesn't feel like 25 years. But
no, it doesn't.
But when I corresponded with him through email to set up the interview, he said, man, it's only been 25 years. It feels more like 50.
I didn't know how to take that.
So, but we'll get the story on that.
Yeah.
And then Wednesday, November 14th, we have Oscar-nominated composer Mark Isham. And we're currently working on a several other terrific interview segments, so watch out for that. But tonight, we're going to be talking about the Eight Films to Die For series, which I'm very excited about. On November 9th through the 18th, After Dark Films will present their annual Eight Films to Die For series in theaters across the United States. This hugely popular event hit big last year with eight distinctive titles that definitely delivered the goods to those legions of insatiable horror movie fans. This year promises to give those fans even more to cheer about, with eight new terrifying films, including The Deaths of Ian Stone, Mulberry Street, Crazy Eights, Unearthed, Lake Dead, Tooth and Nail, and the two films we'll be covering tonight, Borderland and Nightmare Man. First, we discuss Borderland, the film about three college friends who encounter a human sacrifice cult while vacationing in a Mexican border town. Joe Layden of Variety magazine calls the film a brutally suspenseful crime drama with interludes of graphic mayhem. The stunningly effective film is helmed by writer-director Zev Berman, whose previous suspense film Briar Patch received a nomination for the Grand Jury Prize at the 2002 Slam Dance Film Festival and won the Special Jury Award at World Fest Houston. Today, Mr. Berman is joined by his Briar Patch and Borderland producer, Lauren Mays, who has brought to the screen a slate of diverse and unforgettable projects like Cabin Fever and Amy's Orgasm. Yes, I just said the word orgasm. Through her company, Tonic Films. In 2004, Lauren was nominated for Independent Spirit Awards Producers Award, signifying an outstanding achievement for a body of work. And that same year, she was named one of the top 10 producers to watch by Variety magazine. Also joining us is actor Ryder Strong, a remarkable talent who has nurtured a terrific television career in shows like Party of Five, The Practice, and as the character of Sean Hunter in Boy Meets World. Ryder's equally impressive big screen credits include My Giant, Cabin Fever, and two films featured in this year's Eight Films to Die For series, Borderland, of course, and Tooth and Nail as well. It is a great pleasure to welcome Zev Berman, Lauren Mays, and Ryder Strong to the program. Guys, are y'all with us?
I'm here.
Yeah, we're all here.
Great. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for being with us tonight. I'm really excited about Borderland. And my interest was especially piqued when I read that Mr. Berman, this comes from a true life story, in a sense, but one that you had a personal connection to, doesn't it?
Very much so. Back in 1989, I was traveling around the country with two good friends of mine, and we had decided to travel all over the U.S. and then take a dip down into Mexico. And we were crossing the border from Brownsville into Matamoros when we ran smack into the Mexican army, and they were all down there looking for a young college student who had gone missing during spring break. There was search parties. Everybody was out looking for him. There were wanted posters. And, you know, I started to follow the case after I came back to the U.S. You know, we had actually run into the Mexican army in a dramatic way because they made us get out of our VW bus and sort of stood us up against a wall with machine guns. And
Oh, man. Oh, wow.
As if we were satanicos. And you know, obviously, yeah, the things to remember is that we had just come from New Orleans and our VW bus had been filled with, you know, voodoo skulls and things that we'd picked up, you know, voodoo trinkets from New Orleans. And
yeah.
So we did look a little on the suspicious side, but still, it was terrifying, and it left an impression on me. And after I started to follow the case, I realized that this young man had, in fact, been abducted by a drug cartel that was operating on the border. And it was a drug cartel that had gotten involved in the occult.
Wow.
An extraordinary situation.
Yeah, it really seems to be. Now, how long did it take to strike you to actually try to craft this idea or this event into your own script?
Well, you know, it stuck with me through the years. And then after Lauren and I did Briar Patch, which was released under the title Plain Dirty, we decided, you know, to do a follow-up film. And I'd been thinking about it for a while. I had approached a friend of mine named Eric Poppin to help me write it. And we co-wrote the script together over like an eight-month period.
Now, were there? It seems that you were going more than just, you know, the blood splatter and the gore of a lot of horror films out there. You're really going for an unsettling, suspenseful experience. Were there films that you were drawing inspiration from when you crafted the script?
Sure, you know, everything from things like In Cold Blood to Last House on the Left, of course.
Mm.
You know, even things as sort of diverse as Apocalypse Now. I mean, the idea of, you know, Americans taken out of their out of their comfort zone.
Right.
Is a story that gets told, but you know, in this case, since I'd had a real connection with it, you know, I thought that there was a lot that we could say with it.
Yeah. I want to ask both of you, starting with you, Lauren, what did you see in the script when you first read it?
Well, I, too, remember the case. I was going to Tulane University, which is in New Orleans, and it's just out of sheer coincidence. My boyfriend was actually in Matamoros, Mexico, at the time the kid got abducted, and all him and all his fraternity brothers came back saying one of you know, one of these guys that we met went missing. And everybody went to Matamoros for spring break, and after that, nobody went.
Mm.
And then I've never really talked about it. It was a very scary moment because my boyfriend at the time was a drinker and a wanderer.
Yeah.
So it could have easily have been anybody.
Well,
and
I think that's the thing that we all took was it could have been all of us.
Right.
And so, and I never really met another person who had even known of it, you know, in Los Angeles until Zev had mentioned, hey, do you know about this story? Do I?
Mm.
So, you know, just like Cabin Fever, you know, when I look for horror films to do, it's a horror film, but that's not kind of like the others. Cabin Fever is a virus movie. So it's about how badly do people treat each other when they think they're sick.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Borderland was how does a belief system justify the ultimate in bad behavior?
Yeah.
And we, you know, we told a story here about people who truly are doing something horrific because they believe in the power of it.
Yeah.
Lauren's absolutely right. I mean, at the end of the day, to us, this was a horror film about belief. And,
mm-hmm.
and when you've got people that sort of lose the sense of you know, a discussion of ideas and replace for that one idea, you know, that you get the sense that people are sort of vessels waiting to be filled. You know,
right.
Sense of how can people join a cult? How can they get involved in a situation like this? I mean, it's the same questions you can ask about, you know, how could somebody become a human bomb? You know,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
They're dying for what they believe in. And, you know, not that we can make that same parallel here, but at the end of the day, these are fanatics. These are true believers. And to me, you know, that's deeply terrifying.
And it really speaks, and this is the special thing about horror movies when they work, it really speaks to the fears that consume us today. I mean, you're talking about what makes a terrorist and the influence that these ideas can have on people that cause them to take it into the extreme. Ryder, I wanted to ask you too, when you read the script, what drew you to it, and particularly your character, Phil?
Well, for me, I mean, I was 9 years old, so I had no idea that this was going on. No, I was nowhere near
Tomorrow's.
Yeah, rub it in there, Ryan.
No, for me, it was just a great story, you know. And, you know, what was attractive, because I had seen Briar Patch, actually, I saw a screening of Briar Patch the night we started shooting Cabin Fever. And so I knew Zev was a great director. And, you know, what interested me was what you guys are talking about, going beyond the sort of genre element. You know, I knew that Zev's sensibility was going to be, you know, bringing something new to, you know, what otherwise could be a very sort of straightforward slasher movie.
Mm-hmm.
There were all these other thematic elements and tonal touches that he, you know, and you know, was able to bring to the film. And I mean, I knew that going into it because the script was very, you know, it was a page-turner. It was, you know, it's a terrifying story, but there's so much more to, you know, the cult element and the cultural background to this story is just, you know, you can go anywhere with that. And
yeah.
I think the film really touches on all of that.
Well, you said, Ryder, that this was the toughest shoot you've ever been on. Is that true? Is that what you said?
Yeah, that's probably true. But I hadn't done Cabin Fever 2 yet.
Okay.
Lauren can tell you about that. No. This was by far, you know, it was a grueling shoot. You know, primarily just because, you know, I play a character that does get kidnapped. So I spend a lot of the movie physically incapacitated. And lots of physically tense scenes being tied up and whatnot, but also, you know, just the psychological, you know, getting tortured by Sean Astin dealing, you know, just getting to that place psychologically, you know, it's not a fun place to go to.
Yeah,
I can imagine.
So that made for a tough shoot, but ultimately, you know, we had a good time, and you know, these guys were great, and shooting in Tijuana. Very interesting place. Not like shooting in L.A. That's for sure. You know, it wasn't the easiest place in the world because it's not really Mexico, it's not really California. It's like its own world, and you know, that's obviously what Zev was tapping into with, you know, it's why the movie's called Borderland. It's because it's its own country in a way.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's an odd place to shoot. And, you know, we were, I mean, we had a, you know, we actually had one of the, I can tell you a bit more about it, but there was an actual priest of the one of the religions that we were referencing in the film came to the shoot, and you know, I mean, the props that these guys were making and stuff for the movie, it was so realistic, and there was so much research done. It was a really intense set and a really intense production design that went into all of it. It was a lot of fun. It was definitely. To work.
Well, Zev, Ryder mentions two things I want to ask you about. And first of all, the location. How important, how crucial was it to this project to actually shoot on location near that area?
Utterly.
Yeah.
I mean, we you know, Lionsgate paid for a location scout. We drove, Lauren and I and Eric, the screenwriter, and a couple other people drove from Juarez all the way to Matamoros, which was about 850 miles of U.S.-Mexico borderland.
Wow.
And, you know, we were looking for lots of possibilities, and we were looking for, you know, would we be able to shoot this in Texas? Would we be able to shoot this on the U.S. side of the border? And really, you know, the question gets answered pretty quickly, that there's nothing like crossing the border into Mexico. There's no other environment like it, and it's almost impossible to think of it being shot anywhere else. Now, we did at one point consider shooting it in Mexico City or, like, sort of more inland, closer to more production resources, but even that doesn't feel like the border. I mean, Mexico City, and the writer so correctly points out, you know, we really tried to make it clear that, you know, our belief is that, you know, the border environment doesn't belong to either country, but is, in a lot of ways, its own world, and partly that's what drew me to the story in the first place was, you know, the border in general. You know, I've always had sort of a wanderlust and the idea of setting a story there where, you know, you really, you know, I mean, in a way, Borderland kind of meant what, you know, it was meant to sort of harken back to Chinatown, the idea of that sort of mysterious environment where the rules are constantly shifting and changing, and
yeah,
you've got this sort of hodgepodge of elements, and, you know, you've got people who've, you know, definitely sort of living by their own codes. And, you know, I don't want to say that it's, you know, the final frontier in a way, but, you know, it is a mysterious, rich, diverse environment, and there's lots of possibilities there.
And the location definitely lends the film a distinctive visual look as well. And what kind of visual look were you going for? I know your cinematographer, Scott Kevan is his name?
Scott Kevan, yeah. Scott and I met at AFI when we were going to film school there, and he shot my first film, and he's worked with Lauren quite a few times, and he's just an amazing, amazing VP. It's so much fun to work with, and he's got such an eye, and he's really willing to experiment and take risks, and I think that's where we both kind of get excited about working together is, you know, we want to push the envelope, and I think to us, you know, all of us, you know, we felt that the border is such a colorful, extraordinary environment, and he was suggesting things like cross-processing, where you get a really saturated palette of colors, and yet you still have rich blacks, and it sort of also heightens the grain structure. So you get a really unique look when you go after something like cross-processing. And we did a lot of things to affect that look.
Yeah.
Once we get into the border environment, everything has a very saturated feel. And then as we sort of slide into the environment on the ranch, which naturally is kind of a monotone environment, you know, we eventually sort of find ourselves in a very monochromatic world by the end.
Mm-hmm. Lauren, I'm interested because you've had such great success with the horror genre. You mentioned Cabin Fever earlier, and you're working on the second one as well.
Yeah.
What, in your estimation, does a horror film need to work?
It needs fear. So it's like, you know, I can't tell you how many times, you know, I've said that people just roll their eyes at me and I prove my point. Doesn't necessarily need a guy in the woods. Doesn't necessarily need, you know, what everybody considers the genre. It just has to tap into the real concept of what scares people.
Mm-hmm.
And what scares people yesterday and today will scare people tomorrow. So, cabin fever. You know, people, you know, when they get sick, everybody's afraid of germs and getting sick. I mean, I don't know if there's a household around that doesn't have, you know, antibacterial soap.
Yeah.
That's true.
And then you find out that more people are getting the very virus cabin fever is talking about because they're using antibacterial soap. So it's those kinds of things are interesting and make me laugh. Cabin Fever 2 is set in a high school. What better place?
Oh, with what's
for,
going on
for
the last
people
few
to
weeks?
For people to mistreat each other. I mean, it's what a setting.
Tapped
yeah.
into the whole thing that's been going around, the staph infection that's been going around.
Exactly.
I mean, you really hit on the zeitgeist there. Really,
yeah.
Wow.
Well, I know that the first criteria, obviously, is that the film is good. But it does seem that for the independent filmmaker, the horror genre in particular seems like a great route to take in terms of a robust marketplace and distribution opportunities. Am I wrong in assuming that, Lauren?
No, it's absolutely correct. I mean, the job I had to do in trying to sell Cabin Fever as a good investment, because no other horror films had come out in a long time. But if you look at, you know, you look at the marketplace and you actually have an understanding of your audience, you know that they're always there. I mean, really recently, in the beginning of this year, people were like, oh, horror's dead, horror's gone.
Oh, that's
I mean, look what's happening in the next, you know, in the last month.
Yeah.
Look what Saw did this weekend.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. So
it never dies.
No, it never does.
It depends on how many people are trying to get in on the game and don't understand it.
Yeah.
That's what skews the impression. But it's always there if you know how to scare people and you're interested in actually delivering something to an audience and not talking down to them.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's the key, is not talking down to them. I think there's a way to do a smart genre film.
Yeah. And this is definitely one of those. It's been getting raves right and left. But you guys premiered at South by Southwest earlier this year, right?
Correct.
What has that audience reaction been to your film, Zev? And how great does that have to be to see that your film is having this effect on audiences?
Well, you know, I'd always wanted to go to South by Southwest because, you know, Austin is a town where not only do people love music, but they love film, and you can just see it in every fiber of their being. You know, when you have things like the Alamo Draft House where
right.
you know, you can order a beer and watch a movie, you know, people just get into the culture of movies there. So
uh-huh.
I was excited to go. And plus it's in the Southwest. So it's in the region where people would have known about this whole thing going down back in 1989. And in fact, we had, you know, there was a lot of recognition, there was a lot of remembrance, and it couldn't have been a better place to premiere the movie because people got it. They just totally, you know, people who were familiar with the border and familiar with the region just knew that we had, you know, seen it very truthfully.
Mm-hmm. And Ryder, you must be thrilled because not only do you have Borderland, but you also have a role in Tooth and Nail. So you
I
have
am
the horror movie
feature. King, yes. I was surprised because they actually didn't even announce that they had picked up Tooth and Nail until we had already premiered at Screamfest only 2 weeks ago. So
yeah
I knew Borderland and then Tooth and Nail. So yeah, I am two of eight films that
I know you're the series star, really.
Yeah,
you should be the poster boy for the whole.
I should be.
Tell me a little bit about Tooth and Nail.
Tooth and Nail is it's very different from Borderland, which is actually I'm happy, you know, like it would be terrible if I was playing the same character in both movies or they were very similar. But no, Tooth and Nail is a post-apocalyptic cannibal movie,
mm-hmm.
So it's a whole different genre in a way, and you know it's much more sort of, you know, it has none of the sort of far-reaching thematic elements that Borderland does. Tooth and Nail is it's literally just comes down to, you know, are we going to be eaten by these people or are we going to fight? So it's a lot more simplistic and fun in that regard.
Yeah, but just very much a fun movie, I'm sure. But
yeah,
you got to have those kinds of movies. You got to have the cannibal.
No, Tooth and Nail. The story behind Tooth and Nail is pretty funny. I mean, we shot the whole movie in about 3 weeks, and I think they had only written the script the month before.
Oh.
It was one of those things like, let's make a movie, and they did, and I got on board, and we pulled it off. It's pretty remarkable that it actually got finished, and you know, is as good as it is. It was a lot of fun.
Zev, I have to ask you about Sean Astin. Because he's playing a role that he's not necessarily known for. It's really out of character for him to play, you know, the quote-unquote bad guy.
What was
the impetus for offering this to him?
We were looking around for actors that could fill the part, and there are just so many that could have done it, you know, and sort of played it as a typical heavy. But, you know, I have to give credit to George, one of the other producers on the project, who suggested him. And I'm a huge fan of casting against type.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, in my first film, we cast Henry Thomas as a wife abusing, you know, tough guy, low grade thief, and it was a lot of fun. I think when you get actors that don't typically play those kinds of roles, they come at it with an energy
mm-hmm.
that you don't see before, and they bring something really unique to it. And you know, I don't know about you guys, but I sort of thought that Sean was like the heart and soul of the Lord of the Rings. I mean,
he was
like the conscience of it in a way, and he's got this sort of deep humanity, and he's got a natural sense of humor and things that he does. He's, you know, and he was able to bring all of that to the role and go to some very dark places, so that he found a creepiness, he found a bloodthirstiness, and also sort of a goofy humor to it, which is kind of a really strange mix, and it just makes him really unsettling when you see him on screen.
Yeah, it works really well. And I think that I read an interview with him where he said that, of all people, Brian Dennehy convinced him to take this role.
You know, I heard that, and that's not something he shared with me. But I believe it. You know, I mean, it's just something where, you know, I think he hadn't really done it before, and so I know that he was curious about it. And
yeah.
At a certain point, you know, he just it was really interesting to see him take the plunge when he just knew where he had to go with it, and we were all sort of giving him a lot of support to go there, and he said, "Okay, here I go." And it was really a sight to see. I mean, it was something else.
I bet. So Lauren, what does it mean to the film when it's picked up for this series?
Well, I think, you know, I think we're really happy about being in this series. I mean, it celebrates the genre, and it celebrates certain aspects of fear, and gives the audiences a real weekend or 2 weekends of an experience of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think, again, people who understand what the desire is for the fan base are delivering it.
Yeah.
And I understand it did really well last year, so we're hoping for a good turnout.
Now, are you aware, is this because I know it runs a little longer this year, is it two consecutive weekends? Does it play during the week as well? Or
my understanding that it's two consecutive weekends.
Okay.
That's my understanding as well.
All right. Well, guys, I'm sorry we don't have more time. We could do this the whole show, but thank you guys so much for joining us. And we definitely look forward to your film and Cabin Fever 2. Is that in post right now, Lauren?
Yeah, that's in post, yeah.
Oh, great.
When can we expect that?
Hopefully spring.
Great. Okay, yeah. Well, thank you guys so much for joining
us
tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
That is Zev Berman, Lauren Mays, and actor Ryder Strong from the 8 Films to Die For entry Borderland. And now our next guest has been waiting patiently on the phone for. Sorry about the overage there, but writer-director Rolf Konevsky is here. His new film, Nightmare Man, also has the distinction of being included in this year's 8 Films to Die For series. The film has been receiving raves from audiences and critics across the country. Amanda Reyes from Film Threat calls the film a whirlwind of a horror movie with more twists and turns than a hula hoop competition. while Philip Davis Brown from HorrorAsylum.com calls it one hell of a fun ride. In addition to these accolades, the film has picked up numerous awards at dozens of prestigious film festivals. Nightmare Man is just the latest remarkable achievement in Konevsky's distinguished and colorful career, which also includes cult classics like There's Nothing Out There, Pretty Cool, and The Hazing. It is a great pleasure to welcome writer-director Rolf Konevsky to our show. Mr. Konevsky, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. No problem.
I'm really excited about Nightmare Man, and I want to get into that, but I wanted to start out, you came from a creative family. Your mother, I believe, an actress, and your father an editor.
Yes, I'm from New York. I was born in New York City, and my father was a film editor and ran his own post-production facility called Falcon Films. And my mother started as a singer, dancer on Broadway, and did a bunch of shows.
So did
they were very supportive of my career.
So did you always sense that entertainment of some form, whether it's cinema or otherwise, was something that was in your blood in a way?
Yes, it really happened from my memory at the age of like 3.5. My father introduced me to the world of Abbott and Costello.
Yes.
And that was it. I saw the very end of Abbott and Costello, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
I love that one.
It's great. And then I started watching them, you know, religiously. Every Sunday they had on in New York City on Channel 11:30 for years and years. And, you know, I watched them over and over again. And obviously, having told me Frankenstein, Invisible Man, The Mummy, all the monster movies made a very big impact in my career. And, you know.
So the horror kind of comedy genre was something that you immediately felt closely connected to.
Yes. Yeah, I always loved comedy, and I was always intrigued by that blend of comedy and horror where you're kind of scared. And
mm-hmm.
I remember, when I was 5, trying to get through Having to Tell Me Frankenstein for the first time, and it took me 3 or 4 times before I could get through the first, 10 minutes of that movie, because every time Lon Chaney transformed into the werewolf, it was so scary that I ran out of the room. And it wasn't until I finally got to the point where Costello says, you know, get your doggy off the phone, you know, that I was able to get through it all, and I found that to be a great, fun experience as a movie watcher.
Well, it is interesting, though, because it must be a hard thing to balance. I think we've discussed this previously on the show, but horror films, by and large, horror comedies, feeling frightened and feeling amused, those are such similar emotions, such similar releases. It seems like it would be hard to balance the two where one doesn't overpower the other. Do you find that so?
It's a very delicate blend. It's something that, you know, studios and everyone hates to combine genres in the film business because they're panicked, and like, especially if you're doing comedy horror, they're like, well, are they laughing with the film or are they laughing at the film?
Mm.
And many times, you know, studio people don't quite understand really what makes a good horror film work anyway, and they don't quite get that. But it's a great release, and I've always found that a great challenge. And I think that there's, you know, American Wealth in London pulled it off brilliantly.
Yeah.
Fright Night pulled it off. Tremors made it. Night of the Creeps. You know, there's a list of very successful versions. Of course, the Evil Dead movies.
And you're talking about a lot of these movies came up in the 80s.
Yeah.
You know, we went through a period in the late 60s and throughout the 70s where I think maybe the mood in the country lent itself more to the Last House on the Left and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, those kinds of films. And then the 80s, horror movies remembered the fun element.
Right, well, it was through the dawn of MTV, and everything became much flashier and fun, and, you know, you could just watch where Freddy Krueger went from Halloween 1 to Halloween 4 and turned into a stand-up comedian of horror. people were just started having these kind of fun roller coaster rides of these films, and that's why I've always said that. I like both kinds of movies. I like many films in general, but you can have a really good, scary horror film, or you can have a real fun roller coaster horror film that won't give you nightmares, but, you know, you'll leave happy. And I had this discussion when I did a movie called The Hazing, which was, I don't know if you saw that one or not, but it was an absolute complete throwback to the 80s, you know, Hell Night,
yes,
Night of the Demons,
yeah,
you know, Evil Dead films. And the producer was a first-time producer. He wasn't really big a horror fan. He liked the humor in the script, and when we made the film, he didn't quite get it. He wasn't sure, again, if people were laughing with or at the film, and he was worried that it was too funny, and he said, it's cheesy. And I said, yes, it's cheesy. We made it, you know, he said, we made a cheesy film. I said, yes, but you have to embrace the cheese.
Right.
I said, you know, Evil Dead 2, and he says groovy with the thing. That's not scary, but it's fun. The audience can have a great time with that. So you can have a good time with a really scary, disturbing horror movie, and you can have a really good time with a real fun, lighthearted, you know, thrillomedy.
Yeah, and what a great tagline that would have been, embrace the cheese.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, your film Nightmare Man is a little, if I understand correctly, a little darker. I mean, there's moments of humor, but not so much as what you did in The Hazing.
No, that's been interesting to see responses, because I've read a few reviews now that are actually calling it a horror comedy, and I think that's a little misleading, because it is funny, there is quirky moments in there, and people react realistically.
Yeah.
Tell
me a little bit about the story and what inspired you to write it.
Sure. The basic story of Nightmare Man is a woman receives an African fertility mask in the mail that she ordered, and then she gets one that might not be the one she ordered, and because she's having trouble with her sex life with her husband. That night, she gets attacked by the entity or somebody dressed in this mask. Her husband and doctors think that she's a paranoid schizophrenic, so they're going on their way to an institution to commit her for some time, and the car breaks down. So when the husband goes to get the gas, she waits in the car, and again she gets attacked by the Nightmare Man. But is it real or is it in her mind?
Mm-hmm.
She escapes to a house in the woods where two young couples are vacationing for the weekend, and once she gets there, everything bad starts happening, and you know, the body count rises and twists and turns and things like that.
What was the specific challenges in bringing this script of yours to life? I mean, I'm sure that as an independent filmmaker, I mean, every project you're on is like going to war. But
yeah. Nightmare Man, it started as it actually started as a scene from another movie. I wrote a script years ago where it began with a movie within a movie. They're watching a movie on TV,
mm-hmm.
and I wrote like the 3-page scene that had this sort of twist and turn there, and I read it to some people, and they really liked that opening, and they said, oh, I'd like to see that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in post-production working on another film and had a week free where I had nothing to do, so I said, I want to write a script. And I had to think of an idea, and I said, oh, why don't I try to make that into a movie? So I sat down, and 7 days, I wrote Nightmare Man.
Mm.
And it was just as a fluffy little thing. I said, maybe I can sell it or something. It wasn't something I was dying to do. And then people started reading the script and really liked it. And they were like, the twist worked. They thought it was a lot of fun. It moved really well. It was scary. And my parents got behind it. And, you know, my first film that I had done when I was 20 years old, called There's Nothing Out There, we had produced ourselves, so it was a real family project, and my parents came in, they mortgaged the house, we got some private investors, and it was a big undertaking. And it did okay, the film built up a cult following, but didn't make a lot of money, and 17 years later, we decided to try it again. And Nightmare Man seemed like, again, a feasible, limited amount of people in a house in the woods, you know, with a killer, that we could pull off on a limited budget and time frame.
Yeah.
So we again raised some money independently, my parents big investment on it, and decided to try to shoot the film. This time, since I moved to L.A., we had to do it in L.A., and that was a trick because there's really not too many houses in the woods in L.A.
Right.
The ranches that people use, Sable Ranch and all these places where I think Lake Dead was filmed at, were too expensive because shooting at night you have to have fire marshals and water trucks and generators and all this stuff that we couldn't afford. So we had to finally go to Big Bear, two hours out of L.A., where there's a great community there that they do a lot of shooting, and that we could afford to do there. So we put the entire cast and crew up in houses in the area and shot the film in the summer. But that was tricky because almost the entire film takes place at night, and we were dealing with summer nights. So we only had seven and a half hours of nighttime before the sun comes up and you have to stop. So we were always frantically racing to get the shots done. The last day up there was, I think, a record. We shot, it was a 16-hour day. We had a little bit during the day, and we shot 78 setups.
Oh, man.
Oh,
yeah. So my DP, Paul Dang, did a brilliant job, and, you know, it's pretty amazing for it was a 15-day shoot at a very low budget in the summer. I think our film and I guess Mulberry Street are probably the two cheapest films of the festival.
Yeah, but, you know, it's... I mentioned this to Michael Behrman a couple of weeks ago, and I think he thought I was crazy for asking it. But it seems to me that the most effective horror films are the ones that are done in that way, that are done inexpensively, and as a result, I think there's you have to shoot it at such a feverish pace. It feels a lot more kind of unrelenting and primal.
Mm-hmm.
Am I crazy for thinking that?
Well, I guess there's a kind of grittiness that sometimes comes out of a low-budget shoot where you can't light everything beautifully and, you know, that everything's on perfect position that gives it a little bit of a fake documentary feel, which I guess the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre and those films really profit from.
Yeah.
It's challenging, I mean, what kind of style. I mean, I've always liked to tell a story that's, you know, a good-looking film. I mean, I'm a big fan of camera movement, and Sam Raimi was an influence, and I love Hitchcock and Spielberg, and so I like to create a fluidness to a film. When I tend to shoot, I've always gone back to Alfred Hitchcock's Rope.
Yes.
Where I love, you know, the fact, you know, seven takes the whole movie, and, you know, a master shot turns into a close-up, turns into an over-the-shoulder shot, so it's not just cut.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't come from the Michael Bay MTV style.
Well, thank God for that.
Yeah. So I try to create, you know, a fluidness to it all. So, but, you know, when you can't afford a dolly or a Steadicam necessarily all the time, you don't want it all to be shaky and handheld because, you know, after Blair Witch and this whole, you know, that handheld jerkiness that, you know, can make people nauseous sometimes.
Right.
I don't want to overdo that either. So it really depends on the sequence, you know, whereas I feel a lot of filmmaking today, there's a lot of laziness that goes on, that if you have a conversation where, you know, three people are just standing there talking, the camera's handheld and it's just shaking up and down because you couldn't put it on a tripod. It's not necessarily a style. It's sometimes you're just moving so fast, you're just not doing it properly.
Exactly, yeah.
And that drives me crazy. So, you know, if the camera is moving, there should be a reason for it. And yes, if you're creating a frenetic pace where everyone's running around doing something, the camera can be held handheld and you can get that feel. But if everything's static, it should be static. You know,
mm-hmm.
Or you put it on a dolly and have a nice subtle movement going on there.
Well, I noticed that you spoke of your parents helping get your films off the ground. Your father edited Nightmare Man with you.
Yes.
What is that collaboration like? Because editing can be a painful experience to begin with.
Well, we've had a very good collaboration. I mean, he cut my very first film, There's Nothing Out There, you know, he's an excellent film editor. He's you know, won awards. He did a lot of documentaries. He did a National Geographic Explorer and all these documentaries. So talking about the camera movement, it's one of those that, you know, people say we're doing documentary style. It's like, no, a good documentary is actually not shot so it gives you a headache. A good documentary is very beautiful shot.
Right.
You know, everyone says, oh, it's not docu-style. No, it's not. So, you know, you said fake, you know, phoniness. But he's an excellent editor, and he had done a lot of documentaries, but he'd also done some cult horror films over the, you know, some of his more infamous credits, I guess.
Wasn't there Blood?
Blood Sucking Freaks.
Yes.
Oh yes, Blood. Oh, there you go.
Blood Sucking Freaks. He was the post super on Just Before Dawn, also Ganja and Hess, which is a famous sort of blaxploitation vampire tale with Dwayne Jones that Spike Lee actually uses when he teaches courses.
Yeah.
So he has a, you know, eclectic career. But when we worked together, you know, he was on the same wavelength, and we both knew what we were doing. And I, you know, in the script, you know, and same thing with Nightmare Man, I have a lot of transitions and a lot of visualization, and it's all there in the story and when we shoot it. So the editing, he actually says, is very simple in a lot of ways, cutting my films, because it's been designed in a very specific way. It's not like I shoot, you know, 50 hours of footage, and then it's like, let's figure out, let's piece it together.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, so coming from an editing background, since my father was there, I know what I need, so I don't just shoot everything in the world, which we can't afford anyway. So it makes it very easy for that. And he's cut, you know, half or more of my movies over the years.
I know that you work with several films in the horror genre. Tell me about the horror movie fans. The community of horror movie fans out there and your interactions with them.
Sure. Once I really got into horror films, when I knew I really wanted to be a director, I was 14 years old, and I got my video camera when I was 13, and I realized at that time that most horror directors started with, most film directors started with horror films, you know, Steven Spielberg, Oliver Stone, Coppola, you know, they would give, you know, first-time filmmakers a chance to do a horror film because it didn't rely on names or big budgets necessarily.
Yeah.
So I started renting out every horror film on videotape and going to the conventions and the Fangorias and became a fan and started realizing that the horror community is actually, in my opinion, a very intelligent film-going community. They really, they want to like your film. They're incredibly loyal, and they really support the genre more than anybody else. I mean, you don't have anywhere near the websites or the fan base for comedies and dramas and action films as you do for science fiction, fantasy, and horror.
Right.
So I started, when I started going to all these movies, and you'd see people reacting, you know, in theaters when they do stupid things like drop the knife or go into the basement by themselves or, you know, stand in front of an open window. And as I was watching all this, when I decided to write There's Nothing Out There, I was in high school at the time, I said, you know, it'd be fun to actually have a character who's like the audience and has seen all these movies on video as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote this character of Mike, who was a movie fanatic, and he goes through all the warnings and rules with, you know, it's a house in the woods and an alien creature of, you know, how to survive a horror movie. And, of course, nobody pays attention to him, but he's the movie fanatic, and he goes through it all. Which then, 6 years later, became incredibly famous with, you know, Randy and Scream.
They stole your idea, man.
It's the same concept. I mean, it's, you know, there had been comedy horrors before. There had been Student Bodies, which was a complete Airplane parody. There had been a movie called Evil Laugh. There were some movies that definitely dwelt upon it, but I'd never seen that exactly done. So the reaction was great. When we showed the film, you know, it was like audiences loved it. Critics surprisingly loved it because they really liked the comedy. We got very good reviews in the trade papers and L.A. Times and New York Times even. But who didn't understand the film were agents and studios.
Yeah.
Because they were like, well, it's too funny to be scary. It's too scary to be funny. You know, would this anything work for the audience? And yet I was going to all these film festivals and getting great reactions, and people were loving the movie. But they didn't get it. And I said, look, if someone comes along and makes a film like this for enough money and enough budget with somebody in it, you know, it's going to make money. And sure enough, finally was proven correct when Wes Craven did it.
Yeah, but do you find that one of the most frustrating aspects of the process is dealing with those executives who aren't necessarily creatives themselves?
Yes, that's, yeah. I mean, I've had very little dealings with them because I've never been allowed to be on that level. I've had some agents, but I've never been on that map. So you do have a lot of people, though, that don't know. I mean, it's pretty much infamous that, you know, so many people, executives in the industry, do not know the history of the film business. And, you know, their memory goes back about 10 years, and that's it. So you start talking about references from the 70s or before, and they're clueless on, you know, what you're talking about.
Well, they're just concerned with what was a hit last year.
Absolutely, right. Yeah. And I'm always surprised to find that thing. And, you know, I mean, even with movies like Usual Suspects, which I liked a lot, and everyone was comparing it to Tarantino, and I'm like, guys, it's Hitchcock's Stage Fright.
Yeah, it's not.
You know, that's where it's coming from. You're only going back one decade. Go back two more. and that happens all the time. And you know, horror is the same thing. So everything's inspired by stuff. I mean, you know, there was Halloween, but there was Black Christmas, and there was, you know, it goes back and back and back, and you see where the inspirations come from.
Now, is there a filmmaker that you have emulated and kind of wanted to build a model of your career around?
Well, I started, I mean, my first one was, because E.T. made such an impact, was definitely Spielberg was major influence, and I wanted to, you know, either beat him or tie him when he did his first professional film or, you know, TV episode when he was 21 for Night Gallery.
Yeah.
So I was really pushing to do my first film before that, and I did There's Nothing Out There when I was 20. Watching horror films, Sam Raimi became a major influence, and, you know, his Evil Dead films, and I thought was just great.
Yeah.
So he, you know, I started, you know, following his career. I don't think I'd really go into the whole Spider-Man thing myself, and that's not my thing, but I loved his, you know, what he did in the horror genre, and great filmmaker, and the fact that I'm so happy that he and Peter Jackson, who started with horror films, not MTV music videos and commercials, have become two of the biggest directors in Hollywood is great.
Right.
That absolutely astounds me, how people know Peter Jackson now for Lord of the Rings, and I was in love with Peter Jackson for Dead Alive. And those,
oh, absolutely, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Incredible movies.
Yeah.
But I want to also ask you about something that you've written, Blonde and Blonder.
Yeah.
Which is a new film with Pamela Anderson and Denise Richards, I believe. And this was your original script, correct?
Yes. I wrote Blonde and Blonder 10 years ago. as it was sort of very much a female Dumb and Dumber. I wanted to do a younger, sexy I Love Lucy.
Right.
And when I wrote it, I thought in my mind Pamela Anderson and Jenny McCarthy or someone like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we just never got the script to the right people, so it sat around, and years later, 10 years later, producer optioned the script. One of the producers on Nightmare Man, actually, a Brazilian producer named Federico Lependa, and he got it to Pamela Anderson's brother, I think, who got it to her, and before I know it, the film is being shot up in Canada with Bob Clark directing the movie, which I was very excited about because he's been also very influential between his Porky's movies, which very much inspired my pretty cool teen comedies that
yeah.
I've done, and Black Christmas, which I've put homages into in The Hazing and is still a brilliant film, the original, of course.
Right.
So I was very excited that he was directing the film, and then sort of everything went kind of bad, which is why he's not getting directing credit on the film and the horrible tragedy that happened in the car accident.
That was awful.
I mean, it was horrible. Terrible. I mean, no, I was on the set the very last day he directed. I mean, I met him, and he was very, very nice, and you know, his first words to me was like, so is your name still on the project? I'm like, I hope so, because there was a lot of things going on, and there's a thing called Canadian content, which not to go into right now. That
so what?
Money is more important than artistic sensibilities in the film business. If you didn't know,
yeah, that's,
yeah,
that's
yeah, that,
true.
That can cover many, many shows. That topic.
Yes,
there.
Exactly. I could talk about a whole show just that.
Well, what's the status with that film?
Well, the movie's finished. It showed at the Cannes Film Festival last May. I went to see it, and they're up in the air about what they're going to do with theatrical. I know it's going to come to DVD on February 5th. That's the official
okay.
first look is releasing the film February 5th on DVD. It might get a small limited theatrical release beforehand. It really depends on, I think, Pamela Anderson, because one day she's behind the project, one day she's not. She's too busy in the news with everything else in her personal life to
right.
deal with. the film is okay. I try to kind of bring back my favorite Abbott and Costello stuff, and there's a few routines in there that are very much influenced by the vaudevillian comedy of Abbott and Costello, and that was kind of fun to see. But
mm-hmm.
The film did not turn out the way I'd hoped it would have, and we'll see.
Well, but
it'll make money, and it'll do great on DVD, and it'll be a good credit to have.
Now, talk about After Dark Films. We asked the previous guest, what does this mean for your film, for After Dark Films to pick it up for this series?
Well, I mean, for us, it was incredible, because we were literally dead in the water with this movie. I mean, I can say it now. We showed the film. We got great reaction. We went to the critics. We went to Fangoria Weekend of Horrors,
mm-hmm.
and the websites and the film festivals, and everyone embraced the film. And I said we left it up to the fans to decide the fate of the movie.
Right.
And they loved the film, and we started getting all this attention to it, and hired a good producer's rep to try to sell the film, and we couldn't get anywhere. It was like there was a glut of horror films on the market. There's no big stars in it, despite Tiffany Shepis, who's a very good name in the horror community and an excellent actress, and
yeah,
Lizard Mole, Night Court. And but there was like, well, we don't know him. We never heard of him, really. So there wasn't enough drive, and at the point it came to, well, it doesn't really matter if a horror film's good or bad anymore. You just put a good video box on the top, and it'll sell.
Hmm.
So we didn't get any offers, and it was like a year of trying to get this film out there. And then finally, just out of frustration, I went down to Comic-Con in San Diego. And I was just walking around, just spending too much money that I didn't have. And there was I saw a booth for After Dark, and they were talking about the new festival and Skinwalkers and stuff.
Yeah.
So I went to the woman there who happened to be the director of the festival, Sarah Finder, and I said, "How do you select movies for this?" Because last year I know Mike Mendez, who had done Grave Dancers, and Richard Brands, who did Penny Dreadful.
Yeah.
And they were very happy with how the festival went. So they said, well, we just watch films and go to festivals in Tribeca and all these, Toronto, and look for films. Are you a filmmaker? Do you have a film? I said, yes, yes. And luckily, I always carry one with me, so I gave her a DVD screener of it. Because our rep had just quit the film because she said, nobody wants horror anymore. Can you sell it as a supernatural thriller or something else? Because horror's dead. They love to say that, the most famous thing, horror's dead.
Yeah, never count.
Horror's always dead in the film business, even though it makes $35 million opening weekend with Saw 4.
Yeah.
dead. But I gave her the tape and a package on the film, and 2 weeks later I got a call from Lucy, another woman at a horror fest, and she said, well, we lost the film, but we have your package. Can you send us the film again? I said, sure. So at least someone was following up. Sent it out on a Tuesday, actually the exact same day our rep quit the project. And then on Thursday she got it, and I emailed her on Friday just to see if she'd, you know, gotten it, and she said, got it, liked it, watched it, was showing it to other people, and 40 minutes later I got the phone call from After Dark, saying we want the film. And so this was literally just someone walking off the street. I have a movie. Will someone take my movie?
What a dream that is.
Yeah, and it was. So, and that's all it takes. You just take that one person of power to finally say, yes, we like this movie, we want it. And they picked it up, and then it was great. You know, the only issue was, you know, we shot the film on HD, and everything has to be 35. I mean, that's why we did 24p HD. But then we had to do the blow up to 35 millimeter and the Dolby Digital surround sound, and you know it's a major expense that that they don't necessarily cover. So luckily, again, my parents, you know, got through and figured out a way to put the money together to pull this off. So now we have this little movie that's getting this massive release, and it's incredible exposure, and it's for career wise, and everybody involved in the project is great. And
you bet. I mean, it plays in something like between 500 to 700 theaters this weekend. Or not
With November 9th, it opens up. It's supposed to be 350 to 400 theaters, I think.
Okay.
Nationwide, it is playing. I heard at the end of the conversation, it is playing for the 10 days. What they do is they have an all access pass, so you can see all eight movies on the weekends. But then you can also see the films individually throughout the week.
Okay.
So I think a lot of theaters will be playing the films all 10 days, so you can see it within that period of time. And that's my understanding. You know,
and then the DVD releases must be massive, too.
And then the DVD is great. Yeah, I mean, I had heard the last year's sales did great. I mean, I've heard different numbers, but it was over 1 million units sold on these titles, which is great. So, and then now they start on Sci-Fi Channel. And you know, today they're playing a whole marathon of all of last year's After Dark films.
Right.
So their trailer is all over the place. I know there's commercials. There's billboards going up. I'm in, you know, L.A., so there's bus stops all over the place with it, so it's pretty amazing that you know this gigantic. I hear they put like $20 million into PR on this thing.
They must. I know they have so much going on with this, the Miss Horror Fest competition, and they've been all over the place. I think they were on Howard Stern the other day.
Oh, yeah. it's a massive campaign, and they did really well last year. So last year was a weekend. This year it's 10 days, and they're just trying to build it up and build it bigger and better. So. You know, like you said, with our little movie, the chances of us getting this break was, you know, pie in the sky, was winning the lottery. And
absolutely.
It was great. So.
Are you going to sneak into some theaters this weekend and engage some audience?
I'm going to see, it's November 9th, so we got 2 weeks. But I'm going to see them all. I mean, I think I'll get an all-access pass so I can go in, so I won't have to sneak in to see the movie. I'm looking forward to seeing all the other films as part of the festival and, you know, supporting the whole thing and just spreading the word and hope all this leads to bigger and better things for everybody.
Well, congratulations to you. I wish you the best of luck, and please come back and join us in a future episode. We've really enjoyed our conversation today.
Oh, sure. No, I'd love to. Cool. I hope you check out the films. You haven't seen any of them yet, have you?
I haven't seen any of the 8 films to die for from this year's crop, no.
Okay. So, it should be fun. I think, you know, good for horror fans, and it is, you know, it is really one of the few purely independent, you know, festivals like this to get this kind of exposure.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic.
So as everyone says, you know, they complain about, you know, all these remakes and sequels coming out there. I said, okay, well, here's a film festival of 8 original horror films that aren't remakes or sequels or Japanese remakes of sequels.
Right.
and you know, it's like this, you need the support to get out there. You know, people, always bitch and moan about, you know, enough with all these sequels and stuff. But then, you know, when something new comes along, everyone's very weary. It's like, well, nobody did it. You know, it doesn't look like it has, you know, a $20 million budget. Because, well, they don't. But, you know, that didn't stop Halloween. That didn't stop Texas Chainsaw Massacre. the films became it because you gave them a chance. So
absolutely.
You know, you just want everyone to, you know, give the support out there. And I think it'd be good for the whole festival and the horror genre in general, the whole market.
Yeah, I think it's great. I think it's great for the horror genre and the horror fans to have this occur. November 9th through the 18th.
Yep.
We'll look out for it. And thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Okay, no, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye now.
Okay, bye-bye.
That's Rolf Konevsky, the writer-director of Nightmare Man. I kept saying this weekend because, you know, I'm just so used to, and I'm not used to scooping this early on a project.
Yeah, I know.
I feel like a moron.
And this one, the cast for a lot of these films is a big deal.
Yeah.
I mean, Michael Madsen, that movie the writer was in, the other one, Tooth and Nail, like Michael Madsen is in it. I mean, lots of people. I mean, lots of big names.
Yeah. And we have, like, I just go through some of the titles. I went through them at the beginning of the show, but you mentioned Tooth and Nail, Michael
Tooth
Madden.
And Nail, and then, of course, the two we were talking about, Borderland and Nightmare Man.
Right.
Then there's Crazy Eights, and that has Tracy Lords, Frank Whaley, Dina Meyer, Gabriel Anwar.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and then we have The Death of Ian Stone, Lake Dead.
Mike Vogel in The Death of Ian Stone, who is the lead in the new J.J. Abrams movie.
That's right.
Secretive.
That's right.
Yeah.
We have Lake Dead and Mulberry Street as well.
Mm.
So, I mean, there's eight original films for people to check out over a two-week period, and it's going to be a busy time at the box office for those, for the, you know, from there on out. I mean, you got a lot of films to see.
Yeah, we get them here in our little podunk town, the eight films to die for series. So,
yeah, we do.
Very much looking forward to attending those, and thank all the guests tonight for calling in and joining us. And Jerry, thank you as usual for...
Yeah, no problem. And hey, happy birthday, by the way.
Oh, thanks.
Tomorrow, but happy early birthday.
Thank you. Yes, I'm celebrating getting older. So we'll meet you guys again Wednesday night. We thank everyone out there for listening. Wednesday night, A. Kitman Ho and Blake Snyder. Teach us a lesson or two about screenwriting.
That's right.
We could use it. So we'll see you guys then. Thanks so much
for
joining
us. Good night, everyone.